Okay, great. Let's get started. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Glad you're all awake now. I'm glad Scott woke you up with his little comedy routine there. Thank you very much, Scott. So my name's Anna Russo. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. I do TFS and ALM, as you can see. My title, not so fond of it, it's what I do. I work for Imaginet, and I've been doing this since 2008. I'm an ALM MVP, and my background and experience is in testing, hence being on the dark side here. I'm also a blogger at improvingsoftwarequality.com. So I consider myself very lucky to work on a product that I absolutely love. And even more so lucky that I get to talk about what I'm the most passionate about, which is testing and quality. So let's go ahead and get into this. What you're going to learn from this session is really how to integrate the classic testers and increase collaboration to deliver a quality product. And it seems like such a simple thing, right? It's just a sentence, but it's such a huge problem. And if it wasn't a big problem, you guys probably all wouldn't be here in this session. So I really want to give a step-by-step approach of how do I identify and understand where you're currently at today? Because I think that's really the key to establishing goals and then establishing steps to achieving those goals. And then from there, tweaking that and continuously improving. And so I work with testers all the time and with customers for TFS and ALM. And one thing that I see in common is that people think that QA is there to serve the purpose of customer value. They're advocates of the customer. And that is absolutely correct. But is that the only value we want testers to be there for? No, right? There's much more to it than that. We really want testers to be focused on business value, okay? And obviously customer value rolls up into business value. But business value assumes that the fact that the customer may not always be right. The customer may not always know what they want. And business value, the customer may not always be thinking about your business strategy. The customer may not always be thinking about how much money does it take to accomplish this or what they're asking. And another goal, I think, of testers is to mitigate risk, right? They're there on behalf of the business to mitigate risk, not to write up bugs, not to pass tests or fail them, or torture the developers or tell developer jokes. Their main primary goal is to mitigate risk. And it's so hard to capture that because a lot of the metrics that we still have in this day and age really don't do a good job of giving us that information. So how many of us have seen this before? Okay. So it comes from a book, Applied Software Measurement, from Capers Jones. If you've never read it, and you want something to put you asleep at night, I would highly recommend this. But there's some good bits in here. And actually, there's a couple of things in my slides that are referencing this information. Now, how many executives and managers are out there in the crowd? Okay. And how many BA product owners? Okay. And developers? Okay. And testers? Build folks, IT, I see some people raising their hands over and over again. Okay, great, we have a great mix here. And so I didn't see many people raise their hands about seeing this before, so now I'm going to have to explain it just a tad bit. But the whole point is when you find a bug while you're coding, it costs roughly, they're making the average here, about $25. Once it gets to unit testing, $100, because that means you've coded, comes back, it takes more time. Once it gets to function testing, QA, it costs around $250. Once it gets out into implementations or a field test or just a sampling of the population, about 1,000. And then when it gets out to production and post-release, anywhere up to $16,000, right? So it incrementally costs us more money the later on we find a bug. So it is in our best interest to find a bug as early as possible. Now, I do have the question here, though. See this part right here where it says function test, and when QA finds a bug, and it's $250, and when we find it out on the field, and it's $1,000, does anyone think the first thing that comes to mind? Hey, that QA team saved us $750. Let's celebrate and have a party. Who thinks that? See, and we should be thinking that, right? Why aren't we thinking that? We should be celebrating. Instead, the first reaction is, let's put our battle gear on and go to war with the tester, right? And it's maybe intuitive to some, but it's really counterproductive. And so let's go even further, right? If we found it in a field test, however annoying our field people may be, because they're not in the office, they don't get back to us, but they saved us $15,000. Do we yet go, wow, getting this information from you was really hard, and yay, you saved us also $15,000. Let's celebrate and have a party. Nobody really does that. And it makes me question, what kind of culture and behavior are we really encouraging? Everyone says, oh, we should be reducing our costs of bugs. Really? But is this what you normally think of? Probably not. So I thought, well, we need an incentive to reduce the bug cost, right? Because if you're associating bugs with money, we're in a business, right? And so most businesses have to make money in order to survive. There are the outlier ones that have lots of money to do lots of stuff with. I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about the middle of the road folks, right? The majority. Today, in this day and age, the incentive to reduce bug costs is that executives and managers are tasked with go cut costs, go do it faster, and just do it. And you'll get a bonus. And this is actually comes from the same book from Capers Jones. He actually has an entire chart of executives in the IT industry, how much bonuses they get relative to the worker bees. And so the ratio, I thought, wow, that's just staggering. They're doing the work, and I think the software development industry doesn't do itself justice and almost a disservice, but some of the hardest working, smartest people I have ever met. And you look at these worker bees, and they're getting such a small portion of the pie. And is that right? Well, according to Anna and Anna's World, let's say your current bug cost for this year, and this is a metric. These executives and managers should know this metric as well. Let's say it costs $500,000 this past year. And then next year's goal is it's going to cost us $400,000 a year. So we have saved the company $100,000. Now, is this the approach that most used for cost cutting? No. It's usually cut resources, cutting tools, different buildings, just people cut costs in a lot of different ways, outsourcing. And so if we've saved the company $100,000, I think we should all share it and with a different ratio. Because I really believe that the people who are going to solve this problem are the worker bees. Because they're the hardworking, smart, brilliant folks that are going to come up with the solution to the problem, right? Well, we still have to give the executives and managers some, right? So we have to share. Although this may not be accurate. Someone says it's probably somewhere in the middle. Okay, fine. But the point is if you want to give an incentive to change behavior, you have to establish a goal like what we have today and where we want to be, and then how does that benefit everyone, right? And so it's kind of like employee-run companies. employee-run companies make different decisions than larger corporations, right? And so, in case you're wondering what I'm wearing today, I just want you to know that if you come out of this session with nothing else and you point people to this slide, I just want to give you fair warning. You might get some feedback that you have joined the dark side just like me. And so this is not the stuff that people normally talk about, right? And really, it all ties back to business. And I know that's not cool, and that's not fun or geeky in the computer software development world. But it's definitely a good, I think, a good approach, according to Anna. So as I mentioned earlier, managers and executives, what they end up usually doing is saying, okay, we're going to reduce costs, and we're going to reduce time. And then they're perplexed a little bit, like, why is my quality affected? And I'm not sure why, right? Because everyone knows you only get 2 out of 3, right? And you've chosen the 2. So that means consciously you're okay with foregoing quality. You have made this conscious choice. And you know what? I'm here to tell you today, I can do it better than the 2 out of 3. I can do it with the 1 out of 3. If you start with quality, okay? And why would you start with quality? Well, if you start with quality, you're really setting a superb foundation for improving efficiently with cost and with time. And so if you want to know the barometer of where your quality is really at, it's really easy. Take the amount of time that it takes you to do something today, cut it in half, and see if you're still successful. Okay? And if you're not successful, what it really shows is there's something lacking here, right? And you need to address that problem first. And then once you have that level of quality, not that it's a one-time thing, it's always a continuous thing, but then you can go on to the other things, like how can we, now that we figured out what it takes for us to deliver quality, how can we reduce cost? And then how can we reduce time? And this is the exact inverse of the transition that we have made from the waterfall methodologies, waterfall CMMI methodologies, to a more lean, agile Scrum methodologies, right? And it's not a one-size-fit-all, right? And so you have to take into consideration that some of these concepts really are making the assumption you already have this. You already have this foundation in quality. And no one really tells you that, right? And then you end up finding out. And so I know Scott mentioned this as well, that lean is not cheap. Same thing with quality. Quality costs money. So this is a testing quadrant for those of you who are not familiar with this. It's always at testing conferences, has been for the past decade or more. And so you'll see here, it just talks about the different testing quadrants. It talks about manual testing. That costs money. Costs people, time. Automated and manual. Same thing, that also costs money. Purely automated. Let's talk about a lot of money to create these little bots to act on your behalf, right? That's what I call automation is. I call them Anabots. I name them after me. The tooling, right? That costs money as well, okay? So you can see how quality is really at odds with cost and time. And here we go. I hate to break it to folks as well. Quality takes time. I love it when development managers say, okay, we're going to have 2-week sprints, and I'm in their stand-up meetings every single day, and they set the objective with me up front. We want the developers to start unit testing. Okay? And so what they end up doing is creating all these tests for the developer. You know how many times, 90% of the time, the one test that they forget? Where's that unit testing task? Oh, that's in that other task. Well, we're just assuming this is new behavior. We want to track it. We want to make sure someone does it, right? And believe it or not, most of the time, what ends up happening is that the unit testing, the developer never gets a chance to get to that point. because the development managers or product owners or leads end up saying, this is more important than this other thing. We don't have time for this other thing. So people have to give the development team time in order to be able to embed quality into their code. And same thing, these all take varying amounts of time. So obviously in the lower quadrant with unit testing and component testing, functional testing, automated allows you to take a lot less time over time. But there is an upfront cost to ramp up with it, okay? So it's upfront, a lot of time, and then over time, once you build libraries, it takes less time to execute it, okay? Still an investment of time. So the current state of testing. I really want everyone to understand testers. I feel like we are the most misunderstood. And I'm very lucky, actually. When I went to school, I don't know how many people were taught about testing in school. Anybody here? Oh, wow, look at crickets. Okay. No one. Oh, is that one? Okay, I might have seen one hand. One person out of this entire room. Does anyone see anything wrong with that? Okay. So yesterday, James Whitaker spoke, and he actually was a professor at one of the only testing colleges around, the only in Florida. And so I live in Southern California, wasn't too convenient. And so it's such a shame, right? Because what ends up happening is through your professional experience, you end up learning about testing. And then people wonder, how come you don't already know this? And they talk about how to improve quality. How come you don't already know this? I was very fortunate. I had a mentor, a teacher, who was a developer before they became a teacher, and said one of the, a lot of wise things, but one of the things he said, you see this degree you're getting, Bachelor of Science? Don't think that there's anything scientific about this. And so, you know, it's really on point, because a lot of how we approach problems after school seem to be more of the art than I think the actual science. And maybe it should be a combination of both. So the point is I want everyone to understand the different kinds of testers. And based off of that, I'm just going to lump everybody into about three categories for simplicity's sake. There's far more permutations than this, okay? But what I've done is I've correlated testers to the TFS process templates. Because in the industry today, we still don't have, in the testing industry, we still don't have the appropriate classifications for these different types of testers. And the closest thing I could associate it to is what I know, which is TFS. So we're going to talk about CMMI testing, classic waterfall testers, you get the term. So the key differences between these three different types of testing, I've broken them out into categories on the left here, and I talk about the details. And so who does this? People say we should do away with testers and we should do away with these people who are doing waterfall. And I say, okay, hold on here, hold on a second. And it does serve a purpose, and it's okay. Regulated industries, such as medical, you know, financial, it might be beneficial every once in a while. Aviation, with the, like, Boeing 787, right? When people's lives are at stake, people should be far more diligent. And what is this driven by? It's not like people do this out of their own goodwill. No, it's really driven by auditing requirements and laws. And so what I want to go over is the nuances. And I think once people understand the nuances, you can start to outline, these are my goals. And then you get to choose, pick and choose, how are we going to accomplish these goals? And I think people just don't even know how to start at this point. So test case source. So for CMMI, it's specs, requirements, binders, what have you, paperweights. For test case creation, it's purely manual. Some people, it seems like they're writing a thesis with their test cases. It's even hard for me. When are test cases created? Absolutely, we have thought about it for a very long time. and they're always created up front. The amount of time it takes to create test cases, a lot, right? And that's what we traditionally are saying, that takes up too much time. And then test execution. It's very well defined, and then it varies from some to highly automated. And the test execution results, how they capture results, are pass, fail, and bugs, okay? So let's talk about just a little bit more about the CMMI testers. Usually a silo from other teams, right? They are the control group, and they want to test things out. So there's really a methodical approach to quality, which in, if there's people's lives at stakes, I'm okay with that. Take your time. Biggest challenges, getting an updated spec, and dev keeps making changes. How dare that developer, right? Okay, so I'm going to go to the second one, which is agile testing. And so the test case source is the user story acceptance criteria. The test case creation is automated and manual, stub test cases from acceptance criteria. Because we're assuming here the skill set of an agile tester is, I don't need all of the details because I'm a subject matter expert and I have all of that information. I don't need to document all of that. When are the test cases created? Upfront. The amount of time to create these test cases is minimal. And the test execution is a combination of defined, which is the stub ahead of time, and exploratory, because I know how the application works over time. And then the test execution results are pass, fail, and bugs. And who is this audience, right, that this serves? And it's a wide range of industries. And especially independent software vendors, right, where creating a product is your core business. So let's talk about agile testers. They're usually equal contributors of the team. They collaborate with many different team members to ensure quality, okay? And then their biggest challenges really are not enough time. And then people want you to do the same, well, more with the same amount of resources, and there's usually not enough testing resources. And then all the way to the other extreme, the Scrum Lean sort of testing. And here, this, who is the audience here? SaaS shops, social, gaming, in-house software, all the fun stuff, if you ask me. And really, their crowd is crowdsource testing and analytics. This is how they measure things like quality. They're very lucky. They don't have to pay people because they're so popular. Their test case source is PBI acceptance criteria. Test case creation for this group is automated. When are test cases created? During test execution. So it's a simultaneous thing that it's a two for one. It happens all at the same time. So while you're running the test, it's capturing your actions, and then it creates and spits out an artifact. The amount of time to create the test cases, click create. It's very minimal. The test execution, if it's manual, it's exploratory. And the key distinguishing factor here is it's very, very highly automated, right? When you think about software development, every sprint, you're adding on something new and still have to run tests for all of the existing code, right? So your code base and your testing is always increasing. So the challenge always is, how do I get testing done, even though things are increasing, within the same amount of time? And automation is really the key here. And then the test execution results, there's no pass, fail, there's just bugs, okay? And so Scrum testers are just a little bit of a different breed. They usually don't consider themselves testers. They're test engineers. And it really falls in line with everyone on this team is a developer. And their biggest challenges, it's very interesting, is finding skilled resources. And even having the money to afford these skilled resources. Big challenge for a lot of small companies. And then soft skills, right? It's an interesting thing that you end up seeing as far as the soft skills, and why I bring this up is because they're not always subject matter experts as far as their particular domain is concerned. So they can get the work done, but maybe not in the same way a subject matter expert would, okay? And I also love Dilbert, so I referenced all my Dilbert cartoons as well, my favorite ones. And so the testing goals here, so this is all three laid out. And what I want to point out, so there's the two extremes on the end, and I'm just not that extreme of a person. I really like this balanced middle area. And the whole point is you establish with the QA team, and you ask these questions of all these different categories, and how as a team are we going to get from point A, and what is our goal to get to point B? Okay, whatever that may be. And it may be different from what I'm mentioning here today. So like I said, there's lots of permutations, lots of ways to slice and dice this. And so, but I want to point out something interesting about this. I don't know if anyone follows US politics, but are in our Congress currently, we have these extremes. So extreme, we can't get anything done. We can't even come somewhere in the middle. And I just wanted to show this here, all the different ways, what's in common, and how you can come to the middle. Okay? And I think this is really needed, and a lot of folks don't talk about this in the testing world as well. We have to be one defined thing. Not really. It's okay to take good things from one practice and another thing from another practice if it makes sense and it works for you, right? There is no, I know the purists, and they come up to me all the time, and and I'm not that. I'm more of the mentality, if it works, do it. So you'll see here, there's just a lot more in common than the extremes and that would like to admit, right? That we can actually achieve some level of consensus to an approach of testing. So funny how there's certain sentences that are so controversial. This is one of them. Quality assurance is everyone's job. And whereas people say that, it's very interesting how that actually transpires in the real world. So having done TFS and ALM, one of the best things about my job is I get to meet lots of different people. I get to work with lots of different clients. And what's very fascinating about that is everyone has their own definition of this. And I always ask the question, you make that statement that quality assurance is everyone's job, but should we maybe ask some questions first instead of having this mandate, you must do this? Are they ready? Right? Are we ready to do this? How about willing? You know, if you ask a developer who's already working 70 hours a week, right, to do his job, day job, and you are asking him to do something even more and above and beyond that because you have mandated quality assurance is everyone's job, you know, that really cuts into the video gaming time, right? And for the non-video gamers, that really cuts into time with family or doing the fun stuff in life, right? And so it's already stretching individuals who are already too far stretch. And it's not just developers, it's testers, it's build engineers, right? IT. It's, like I said, it is always amazing to me, coming from working in other industries, that how hardworking and the work ethic of the software development industry. It's just unparalleled to anything else. So there's the willing, and then there's the able. You know, so we didn't teach you this in school, even though you have that degree. We didn't onboard you and train you on this. We're not sending you to conferences because of budget cuts. We don't have time for lunch and learns, let alone lunch. And we expect you to accomplish this. What are we really doing? Are we setting individuals up for success when we're not asking ourselves this question? Are you able to do this as part of your new job? And so, as I stated before, there's varying degrees that people feel that quality assurance is their job. So just different degrees of responsibility. And so I've kind of broken it out here. and you should be able to identify with at least one. The proactive approach is you're preventing fires, okay? The active approach is you're doing the occasional firefighting, right? The very reactive approach is, hey, firefighting, at one company, I promise you this is the truth, they gave out firefighting hats. And I said, what is that? And they said it was an award. And I said, for what? Fighting a fire. And I said, oh, this has hit an all-time low. We're encouraging this behavior, and people have firefighter hats in their cubicles. This is a disaster. And I was just like, okay, where's the person who's going to create the next fire? Oh, let me look for the one who has the most firefighter hats. Inactive. This is just over time. I'm not sure what people expect, but people get burnt out by all these fires. This is just not a normal, healthy thing of how you should be living at this pace all of the time, right? And so I think this really hits home to what mode are you in today and where do you want to be? So now I'm going to transition a little bit into the kind of step-by-step approach after you've established what kind of testers you have, what your goals are of where you want to go. I'm really going to talk to what I talk to normally at customer sites of how do you get there, okay? So you have a plan. How do we execute upon it and make it happen? So the first thing I think that's probably the most important is a team approach to managing work. And it's so understated, but what's fascinating to me is TFS has usually been acquired by development teams. Obviously, hey, we had VSS, we need something better. Anna, install TFS for us. Okay, great, no problem. And then they go, I heard it has other stuff besides version control. Oh, you notice that? It's great. We have work item management. And it's like, oh, we got to keep track of our work? That sounds like work. But even after we get over and through all of that training, I always am fascinated. I always loop back with customers. I go, so how are things going? How much or what parts of TFS are you using? And it's usually version control first, and then work item shortly thereafter, and then builds, right? Those are usually the first three things that clients implement in TFS. And I'm always fascinated when I'm in stand-up meetings, when I'm in project management meetings, time and time again, testers are not assigned tasks. And I always find it very fascinating. And I've never understood the phenomenon, right? And then I came to think about it and I realized, well, they're not always integrated into the product team. So sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not there. And if they are there, sometimes they're asked to be quiet, which I thought, well, that's a little interesting. And testers are usually not part of stand-up meetings, right? Because heaven forbid they tell us something important that just happened, right? And then testers' productivity. I don't know why time and time again, I always hear this comment, I have no idea what the test team is doing. Can you go and figure that out? Sure, no problem. And more times than not, they're just as hardworking as the development teams, right? But my general rule of thumb when I'm teaching TFS and work item management, people always ask, under what scenarios should I be entering in work items, when, how? And I always have just a very simple rule. If it's not in TFS, it doesn't exist and you don't get credit for it, period. So it just really sets the baseline. If it's anything related to what you are doing, you need a TFS work item for it, okay? So all in one shot, some of those categories, test case source, test case creation, and effort, there really is a tie between the BA product owner and the testers. And really, the BA product owners are the liaisons between the customer and the tester. It's very rare that I see the tester comes directly in contact with the customer. And so we're relying upon this interaction and collaboration to be solid in order to make sure we have fulfilled our goals. And so this interaction here is either a failure point or a success point, right? And you need to make sure that this interaction, this collaboration is successful. And what are you doing to make that happen? So one of the things that is in a user story is PBI acceptance criteria. And, you know, this is one of those things that's such a simple little concept, but I went out there looking for a tool that can turn acceptance criteria into test case work items for TFS. And I couldn't find one. And I was like, really? Wow, we're still in this day and age, and there's nothing really automated about this process. We have this great information. And what do we do with it? We copy, paste, and we do it all manually and fill out all the fields. And so, and that's until last week. And this, I'm going to say, shameless plug here. But I've created a tool that automatically turns exploratory test cases, and they're auto-created from the PBI acceptance criteria. So what you saw here is there's two acceptance criterias, verify opt-in, verify opt-out, and I automatically create test case work items from it. Now, I must warn you, it's in beta because I released it very quickly in between my day job. And so it's available as a beta on the Visual Studio Gallery, and Chuck Sterling put it on the blogs for MSDN. And I've already received a lot of wonderful feedback. So that's after he put that post out there, my email, my inbox, all about the tool. So I've received a lot of positive feedback. Still would love to receive more positive feedback. So there's a short URL for it. It's on the Visual Studio Gallery. Download it, check it out. Let me know what you think. The whole point here is people say that you need to take this acceptance criteria and do something with it. And why not automate this? Why not help testers become efficient in the test case creation? Because as far as test case artifacts, right, the value in that test case artifact, that test case work item, the more valuable activity is actually testing, right? So it's an opportunity cost when you ask someone to write a test case, and because that means they're not testing, right? So if we efficiently create these test cases, it allows them to focus on what we want them to be doing or spending the most of amount of time on. So let me show you a quick demo of the tool, because sometimes people give me feedback about tools and go, Anna, it's really hard. I want you to know it's really easy. So I'm connecting to TFS here. Like I said, this is a very simple tool. Click connect. Going to find my query. So here I'm in Sprint 2. I see all of my PBIs. All I'm doing is just parsing the acceptance criteria and using this field right here. And it's only in Scrum right now, so if you have other templates, people ask me, hey, if I put this into the Agile template, can I use it? Absolutely. The next version, I was working on this, I'm going to allow you to put any field in here. All I have to say is you better get that field name right, because it's pretty long usually. So all I have to do is click, so I have 10 PBIs, I click create 10 cases, I have about 5 acceptance criteria for each PBI. And yes, it's going to take a little moment here, but I promise you it's much faster than creating 50 test case work items in TFS, manually copying and pasting, right? And so you'll receive a status here. This is also hitting TFS preview, and I'm on this Wi-Fi. It's much faster performance when I'm usually wired in. So once it creates these 50 test cases, voila, wow, I can now get to testing. So one of the most exciting things that happened yesterday, the highlight of my day, was when Brian Harry announced web test management. And so you'll see here I had 0 test cases for Sprint 2. And with my little utility here, and if there's, there you go, voila, we have 50 test cases. Okay? And more importantly, what I'm very excited about is you'll see here that the PBIs have the test cases associated with it, and everyone, this is where the team approach, right? Everyone has access to this. You don't have to install anything. BA product owners, testers, developers, and this is the whole concept that drives home the team approach to test execution. I absolutely love this UI, and I think this is really the starting point of the next generation of testing tools. Okay, and I can simply go in here and highlight this, and well, I should be writing an app. Let's pretend we have. And I can pass, I can easily fail and block and say things are not applicable. But the whole point is I'm allowing testers and everyone else on the team to be able to contribute to quality, right? When testers are done developing code, what are they doing, right? They can help out. And that goes back to the fact of how everyone can contribute. So I absolutely love the tool. I think this is just a wonderful way for everyone to have a way to contribute to testing. And then everyone else can see what everyone else is doing, right? This pass, this fails. So it's very easy to understand real time what is going on. You don't have to wait for the stand-up meeting in the morning or an email, right? And so another neat thing is one of the customers I worked with, they had a monitoring tool right when you walked into their dev area. And I think that's great, right? IT departments get the fancy server monitoring tools. Why not the development team? And so it just really connects everybody. And so people know really where things are at, okay? Okay. So the team approach to test automation. So this is what I used to do before I worked on TFS and ALM. And it's very interesting. People wondered when I left, Anna, you know that's not testing, right? You do test automation. And really, I'm not sure they ever understood my goal or what I felt like was my purpose, which was automation was a means to improving quality, right? And I just thought it was a very natural fit that in TFS 2005, I could see the vision of how TFS across an organization could help improve quality. And here I am still today. And so when we talk about test automation, there's a lot of myths, unfortunately, in the testing industry and development world about creating a functional test automation framework. And this is very specific for functional test automation. My thought is that it probably would take a developer far less time in Visual Studio with the coded UI to create a testing framework, because developers already know how to separate actions from objects from data, okay? And not anything against the automation testers, but just so you know the testing landscape, it's about 80% manual testing, subject matter experts most of the time, and about 20% automation testers. And out of that 20%, there's only really 5% that fall under this category that it can actually accomplish this, okay? Another reason I think the development team is a great candidate to create this is because they have a vested interest in it, right? They've created it, they understand their application, not that an automation tester can't, just takes time to ramp up. And I kid you not, because coded UI, one of the things I think that's brilliant about it is it really breaks one of the barriers. And this is why automation testers, there's that 15% that may not necessarily understand how to do this, is because they're very tool specific. So if you know QTP, you know QTP, right? If you know rational, you know rational. And so in coded UI, it's in Visual Studio. You get to use C#. Not too hard to find a C# developer, right? But the more important goal here is the collaboration on functional test automation. Once you create a framework, and you really need a framework to be successful, okay? One of my first jobs was I had to maintain automation test scripts, and I guess that's how you earned your stripes, doing all the grunt work. And let me tell you, it was so painful. I thought there has to be a better way. And everyone told me at the tester conferences in the company and everything, Anna, there is no better way. Get over it. Never could let it go. And once you figure out test automation frameworks, and like I said, developers know how to create frameworks as well, it just makes sense. It really helps reduce maintenance and makes a lot of things reusable. And although I hear testers tell developers, oh, that's really bad that you hard-coded this. When I review usual tester automation scripts, let me tell you, they are the worst offenders. They hard-code things. And the whole goal here is that it should be accessible to everyone. If it's so complicated that everyone can't contribute, you need to figure out how to make it accessible to everyone. Developers, manual testers, BA product owners. And developers are usually the ones that question me the most. I don't know if it's in their nature or what. But when I ask them that they should be contributing to this, I always find it very fascinating that they think it's more work. And then I always tell them, okay, so if you can easily create this automation script, when you have to fix that bug, maybe it's already in the library. Maybe you have to do a few simple things, but when you compile your code, how about you run that automated test script and go have a cup of coffee? And they go, oh, you mean I don't have to be at my desk and watch it? You know, it really defeats the purpose if you're sitting there watching your automation run, right? If you want to scale the automation, for small things, it's fine, especially if it's just new. But if you want to scale automation, you really need to be creating a test lab, right? Because it needs to be running unattended. And the whole point is everyone is contributing to a centralized library, right? And so it's really just the power in numbers, okay? Team approach to builds. It is very sad to me when I go to a customer engagement, every time it gets me, that builds in this day and age, for how long we've been developing software, still not automated. Oh, comes from the developer's machine, and I'm copying to this other location. And this is how we do builds, Anna. What is wrong with that? Everything? And, you know, it's with TFS, one of the things, like I mentioned before, that people implement, one of the first few things is, I always encourage people to automate builds after you put your version control in. It's just seamless. It doesn't cost anything. And it's one of the highest occurring activities, right? So you get the highest return on investment for something that happens so often. But unfortunately, automating builds to QA environments, not that common. And so what ends up happening as a result of that is a couple of things. The QA folks go, oh, there's another build coming. That's not going to work. And there's just a lot of QA build downtime. So let's say you're trying to get to that middle area of agile testing. And, you know, you only have a 2-week sprint. And I've seen people even do 1-week sprints. And you just don't have the time. And then you don't have access to an environment. It does not benefit anyone on the entire team that you don't have a testing environment to look at your work in order to be able to successfully mark off that you're done, right? And this is one of those things that when I see that this is a problem, on a day-to-day basis, I keep track of how much downtime, times how many man hours we expected this activity to take, and how it's been stolen from the team, right? I'm saying the collective team, because it really doesn't benefit the development team either if later on, after things have been released, they get even more bugs, right, that potentially QA could have found. And so another thing it leads into is, as I mentioned before, is running those automated tests unattended. And so this is the key part, is you run a build, and you run varying types of tests. Build verification test if you want immediate results. These are high priority one test cases, right? If things take longer, then you need to put that in a secondary priority two bucket. If things take longer than that, priority three. And absolutely without a shadow of a doubt, depending on how long these tests take, the entire suite should be at a minimum run every single day. And if it doesn't take that much time, multiple times a day, right? It doesn't cost you anything to have things run unattended on machines that you're not actively working on. So take advantage of that, right? We have the technology available today to be able to do this. And then reporting on build quality indicators. This is probably one of my favorite reports in TFS. How many folks know this report? Okay, a few folks. I don't really know what it says about me, that this is my favorite report. But I really want to, if you've never really looked at this report this way, when customers have problems, they release to production and they get a lot of support incidents. They wonder, why does this happen, Anna? Can you help us fix this problem? And so the first thing I start doing is gathering data and information and assessing the situation. And you know, it's one of those things here in this report. You'll see here the team had 7 bugs, and this particular organization here measured quality by bug count. And people still do it today, but it's not the most accurate assessment, right? And so clearly, if we go from 7 bugs to 2 bugs, our quality has improved, right? The number's smaller. That means better, right? No, absolutely not. And so this is an extreme scenario, I'll admit, but it was reality. What happened here is we had 46 from this point to this point. There was 46 lines of code change. From this point to this point, over 500 lines of code changed for these 5 fixes. Does anyone find that disturbing? You should, right? And what we ended up seeing is when the support incidents increased, there was a pretty close correlation to how much risk, which by lines of code, we were taking, right? And it was pretty close. Now, I have to admit, there were those times where, literally, it was only a line of code, and it had just as catastrophic of an impact, right? So it doesn't always work out, but averaging out, this is a pretty good indicator. Should we really be releasing, or should we be doing something about this to mitigate this risk? Okay? So do we pay now, or do we pay later? So a team approach to environments. IT and testers. Having been a tester, IT was always so very nice to me. My boss would tell me, hey, you have to send them an email. It ends up in their queue. And you have to tell them exactly what kind of machines you would like. And I always had environments that were pretty sophisticated, so there was quite a long list. They were not very happy about how long it took to create my different environments. And then I would always follow up my email with a personal visit for me to make sure, hey, guys, do you know when are you getting around to getting that done? Anna, we have this fire. And so, you know, there's always something going on, far more important than little tester Anna. And some people would go, who are you again? You're a tester? Are you lost? What are you doing here, right? And so there came a point in time when the IT director, who was right outside the IT department, kept on seeing me there. What are you doing here again? What do you think I'm doing here? I'm pretty consistent. I only want one thing. And so he ended up giving me multiple boxes, multiple actual servers under my desk. And I had no idea what would happen as a result of that. But somehow I got a lot of attention from developers. And how'd you get so many? And why do you have so many monitors? And then, you know, it's very fascinating as well is I would be running automation scripts on all these different monitors, and they're like, what's going on here, and who's doing this stuff? And it's like, this is automation, and these are my little Anabots. And that's how Anabots came about, because the developers were like, okay, 4 different mouses, and you're not touching any of them. And I'm like, yep, Anabots are doing all the work. And they're like, you have created Anabots, so in order for me to get this, I need to create Anabots too. And they were just interested in the hardware, really. They weren't really interested in what I was doing. They just wanted to know how I got it, which I thought was very fascinating. And so you'll see here, if you don't already know, in MTM, there's a lab center. So obviously, there's 2 different popular virtualized technologies out there. There's VMware and there's Hyper-V. Okay, this has a Hyper-V backend, but don't stress, if you have VMware, you can also use this, but you can't use it to self-provision, okay? So you can create a standard environment, you can connect to it, and you can do your work. And usually when I have conversations with IT departments of setting up a Hyper-V infrastructure, wow, those are intense meetings. And my usual conversation goes like this. Hyper-V is for your dev test environments, and VMware is for your production environments. So both can coexist in parallel. I promise I will not take down your other infrastructure. I won't even touch it. And then when I talk about the benefits of people like me, and the story I've told you, not coming up to you for all of these things, and they can just click a button and not bug you anymore, as long as you know they don't run out of RAM and you know hard disk space, they can do it themselves. Done. Okay? So don't be afraid to ask for these things. And what I love about this is this empowers me as a tester, as a test automation person, even developers. You'd be even surprised. Documentation people love this too because they need different environments. They're not very tech savvy, but they need to take screenshots, right, to produce documentation. And all I have to do is click start, or actually go to the library, pick the environment that I'd like, and then click start and connect to it. Such a seamless, simple experience, right? But this really allows you to scale. What's also really neat is, I don't have it in this screenshot, but you can also peek into, hey, what's going on with automation? You know, see how things are going, take a peek, are things okay, are things not okay? So I absolutely above and beyond love MTM Lab, okay? Because I just think, where was this when it was my responsibility and part of my job? And the last thing I want to touch upon here, and I'm running really close on time here, is continuous improvement, okay? There is no one silver bullet. There really isn't, okay? And so one of the things that you can do for continuous improvement is reporting. I think it's really important. And this is also from the Capers-Jones book. So I've kind of given you the cliff notes of the important stuff here. But really, when you're measuring something, I always question people, how are you using this information, right? And how does it benefit? And how does it help us get better? And so I see metrics as one of those things that there's just not one out-of-the-box set of metrics and it'll work forever. We're going to change, and therefore the information we need is also going to change. And so I really love this when I saw this in the book. Measure to know, and then know to change, right? If you just know, like the bug cost stuff, and it doesn't facilitate any change, what's the point, right? And then change to lead, right? So I think this is great. And then just my last little spiel here. People always ask me, Anna, you've seen a lot of teams over the years. Yes. Any last bits or words of wisdom? And there's two different teams here, really into cycling. And so the team here on the left, you'll see that they're a little bit staggered. They're not as matchy-matchy as the pro team, right? But their goal here is to ride a 100-mile bike ride, right? And so if they have this formation for a 100-mile bike ride, it might hurt a little bit. And I can say, speaking from experience, I've learned this the hard way, you will not want to see a bike for 2 weeks. You won't want to touch it. You won't want to look at it. Cycling will go from, I love cycling, to, oh my God, I hate cycling. And what are the differences between this team and the other team? Now, people always point out to me, hey, that team, it's okay if you're doing a short distance. And they're absolutely correct. If you're just doing a short distance, the little details don't really matter, right? But what the pro team understands is, I don't know how many folks have seen cycling, but usually the person in the front, it's brutal to be in the front, right? Because if you have wind coming at you, you are working the hardest. And when you're ducking behind someone else, you conserve a lot more energy, and it's a lot more efficient over 100 miles, right? And it makes you not want to hate the bike for multiple weeks at a time, right? And then there's a rotation that everyone takes a turn, and everyone stays in the front, unless there's a superstar, and they kind of get to hide in the middle a lot, and everyone else rotates around them, right? But the whole point is you conserve a lot of energy, and you can be efficient. And the whole point here, from going to good to great, it's not a lot of big things. It's a lot of little things that add up. Okay. Well, thank you everybody for your time. I am clearly out of time. I'm surprised Keith hasn't stopped me.
It was tremendous. Well, how could I stop? Thank you, Anna.
Welcome.
And now we have a 15-minute break, and you can flood the stage and ask her all your testing questions. And you face one of the most difficult choices of the conference, whether to stay in this room for Mick Kirsten and Dave, or to go next door for Brad Wilson. That's a toughie. But they're both being taped, and you'll be able to see the one you're going to miss in a few weeks.